Just a quick content note. This episode discusses chronic pain, disability, neurodiversity, and lived experience in research. These themes include personal reflections on illness, embodiment, and medical care. While the conversation is supportive and aims to promote understanding and inclusion, some listeners may find aspects of it emotionally resonant. If the issues raised in this episode affect you, please see the support and resources linked below.
Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. I'm Helev, a Researcher Development Advisor at the University of Leeds. Today we're exploring a topic at the intersection of research, lived experience and disability. I'm joined today by Dr. Nico Meller, who completed a PhD in School of English here at Leeds just a couple of weeks ago. I'd like to offer my congratulations to you. Nico's work looks at how 21st century women writers express experiences of chronic pain, blending research insights with their own lived experience of chronic pain, disability and neurodiversity. Before her PhD, she held a Wellcome Trust Master's Scholarship and worked in higher education. The topic today is close to my heart. My mum, now 82, has lived with chronic pain for over two decades. After years of back and neck problems, including a recent serious neck fracture and a spinal cord compression, she still insisted on travelling to France for a family holiday. Afterwards, her mobility collapsed and she now wears a permanent neck collar and needs 24-hour care. And yet her grit is extraordinary. She loves to travel and to see the world, and she has seen the world. And for her 80th birthday, she went to Cambodia and Vietnam with her 90-year-old best friend who struggles with her sight. "You be my eyes and I'll be your legs," is what they joked about. One memory feels really relevant to today's topic. In 2012, my mum visited me in Leeds and we were walking to the German market and I could see she was struggling. I asked how she was. She says, "Not too bad," which is what she always says when her pain is often at its worst. I said, "What's your pain out of 10? And she smiled and said, "About an 8. And I suggested that we should stop, but she insisted that we should carry on. Her resilience is inspiring, but it can also mean her pain is misunderstood. She doesn't want to cause a fuss, so she just grins and bears it. I'd just like to welcome you, Nico, to the podcast today. Would you like to say hello to our listeners?
Yeah, hi. Thanks very much for having me.
So, Nico, your work really examines how pain is seen and measured, not just medically, but also culturally and personally. So this brings me to my first question. You've written about pain scales and assessment. What issues do you see in how pain is measured and how do these affect disabled or neurodivergent people?
Okay, so I think one of the main issues that I would say is that when we kind of asked, how is your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, for example, it's only really a measure of intensity. It doesn't really measure anything else to do with the pain, such as the felt experience or the significance for the person. And I guess with a backdrop of constant pain, it can also kind of limit that because it forces you to kind of focus on one specific snapshot, which doesn't necessarily give a good impression of what it's like to live with that pain kind of long term, or how this new sensation might be kind of making its way across in contrast to that ongoing experience of pain. I think in terms of neurodiversity, I'll draw on my own personal experience here, which is that I've been told that I find it very difficult, or that people find it very difficult to understand my kind of mental state because I kind of often appear quite happy or fine. And there can be this intense inner turmoil going on and I can be absolutely devastated, but nobody would know. And because often people kind of have an affective response to pain, it means that for me, it can be difficult to get that intensity of that pain across when I just appear really calm. I've had things like broken bones. I've had things like I had a 4-centimeter gallstone. And during all of these things, people very much couldn't quite believe the extent of the pain I was in until they looked at those kind of objective signs. But I think it's also really important to mention that we mentioned about disability and pain. I think that although I have disabilities that cause pain, and so many other people have the same thing, it's important not to kind of conflate disability and pain. I think that's a really important point, because sometimes people can sort of be quick to make assumptions that somebody that does have disability is in pain, and that can lead them to kind of make judgments about that person's quality of life, which aren't necessarily accurate. It can also lead them to kind of stigmatize disability, because people quite understandably fear pain, and that can cause them to feel more fearful around the topic of disability. So those are the issues that I would say.
That's brilliant. That's a really powerful insight. Just the idea of what can't be measured and things that really get overlooked a lot of the time. And just your perspective on feeling, not being able to verbalize that pain, or people seeing that you're coming across as positive person, but that inner turmoil, I can really kind of relate to that. And I can see that in my mum as well, that not wanting to kind of, or not finding those right words to kind of explain how you're feeling.
Yeah.
So your thesis explores how women write about pain. So what drew you to this topic, and what kind of narratives did you engage with?
So, I engaged with quite a few instances of writing, which I think they were all life writing. So I looked at a few memoirs, lyric essays, which are really interesting because they're sort of like a blend of poetry and prose, and even an autoethnographic account, which is a woman that was writing about her experience of pain, but seeing herself in the past as this other person who she names that person S. So there's this really interesting sort of divide between the narrator and the person that experienced the issues being narrated. I guess what drew me into this topic was partly my own experience of chronic pain. So I have a condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which causes me to dislocate joints. And that's also caused me to have some osteoarthritis, which was diagnosed in my 20s. And I also have fibromyalgia. And I guess what kind of drew me to this was that when I was volunteering with arthritis care, I met lots of people that found it really difficult to articulate their constant experience of pain. So sometimes I would meet with an individual that had a new diagnosis, a family, or on one occasion I worked with a group of South Asian women with the help of an interpreter. But people were kind of coming to me with the same issues of saying, well, I can't sit down and cry about it now. It's been going on for years, but that means that nobody's believing me and nobody understands how bad it is. But being a person who's always, I've always been infatuated with words and reading. I know that the way that we make sense of our experience as humans is through narrative. And narrative kind of has a beginning and a middle and an end, and that's how we kind of organize our own experiences. But when you kind of try to put pain into a narrative and that pain has no ending, I was really interested in exploring what is the effect of imposing an ending on an experience, because those are the rules of narrative, so to speak, when that experience kind of continues to outlast the narrative that's been written or published or spoken. And that's kind of sort of what drew me to the topic. And also the sense of, well, what if you have a narrative where lots of exciting things are happening, but the person's just kind of constantly going, right, and then nothing happened for a while because I just had to sit down for 2 weeks. And I just really wanted to see kind of how does that play out in a narrative?
That's fascinating. Maybe seeing it from that perspective is really powerful. It must be really challenging to meet people who struggle to articulate that ongoing pain and then capture it that within that kind of story form. So you're right that the pain does continue beyond those neat narrative endings, as you've talked about, and it's really hard to convey. You've also brought in your own personal experience and embodiment as part of your methodology. So how did your own experience in university and chronic pain shape your research approach?
So I guess it almost seems kind of accidental, really, but I suppose I'll start with when I was working on my introduction in my first year. So I was reading a lot about different things to do with disability studies and the social model of disability and expressions of pain. And whilst I was reading all of this stuff, I had this bizarre stomach ache that just wouldn't go away. And it went on for weeks and weeks. I remember talking to people in my year about it and saying, what do you do when your reading kind of causes these intense embodied reactions? And they were sort of like, well, I don't really know, but maybe you should go to the doctor and get some help for your IBS. And I didn't know this at the time, but I think it's kind of quite common for people to talk about their cognition and their thinking in terms of like kind of having a little voice in their head that sort of says things, and those are the thoughts and those are the way that they kind of understand the world. But I've never really had that experience. I've never had an inner voice. And so I came to understand that the stomach ache was just kind of like my response to the reading and my response to seeing something about me that wasn't being represented in those texts. And so I guess that was a sort of starting point for embodiment kind of leading me on this journey of kind of approaching these texts and sort of reading about different types of experiences and having those experiences in my own body. And I think I also really, really wanted to draw on my experience of neurodiversity, because I think that sometimes in academia, we read these like incredibly coherent and polished arguments that seem absolutely flawless. But when you have chronic pain, it could be that you read half a page and you need to have a break. And then you come back to read the next half and the meaning of what you were reading has completely changed because you've had to have that break. Or experiences like dissociation, or the fact that I have ADHD and dyspraxia, which can mean that when I am reading, especially with the dyspraxia, I can find that the letters kind of move on the page. And I deliberately didn't want to kind of obscure that, because I felt that that was a really important way for me to kind of approach the meaning of the text. And in reading about chronic pain, it felt entirely appropriate to say that the meaning of the text I was reading did change because my chronic pain meant that I had to have a break from that. And so, yeah. And then I suppose that in what sort of turned out to be the structure of my thesis, which follows narrative explaining experiences of assessment, invalidation, diagnosis, and treatment, I felt that it was really important for me to bring my experience of those particular issues to the text, because I feel that these kind of disabled perspectives haven't always been sort of welcome or highlighted in academia. And lived experience within the body is such an important way of understanding the world or understanding things like ableism, that I just really felt that it was important to try and bring that to my analysis as much as I could, and to sort of resist the narratives of sort of trying to make everything very coherent and polished, when it felt really important not to kind of miss those ways to meaning. I wanted to kind of keep them in there.
That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that so openly and explaining it really well. I found it really powerful that you've connected your physical reactions, like the stomach pain you described, almost as like your body was reacting to not seeing your own experience reflected in what you were reading. And then the way you've embraced that along with your neurodivergent perspective to shape how you read and write. It's such an important reminder that our ways of thinking and processing information are deeply embodied and also really unique. You also mentioned how those embodied and neurodiverse experiences aren't always fully recognised or welcomed in academia. And that really resonates with ideas about inclusion and research culture. So how do you think research culture could better support embodied or experience-based methodologies, especially for disabled researchers?
So I guess that my thinking here is that there is probably quite a lot of work out there where people are drawing on their experiences of embodiment, and researchers such as Tobin Siebers, for example. So he was a disability theorist who claims that the experiences that we have as disabled people are theory, and so that these are really important insights which allow us to kind of unpick discriminatory experiences and things like that. And so I would kind of say that it is really important to kind of reflect on those and bring them into our kind of analysis and things like that. I think in terms of research culture, I think it would be quite positive to kind of share resources and have, you know, things like chapters and things which people have found particularly speak to what it's like being a disabled researcher. I think having an open conversation and sharing those resources in a kind of, you know, some kind of university platform or something like that would be really beneficial. My school has enabled me to kind of do an embodied reading seminar, which I did a few years ago online. And that was really, it was fascinating, because I didn't know how other people were going to receive my work other than my supervisors. And it led to a really interesting conversation. And I think things like that, I think allowing people to kind of have that platform to kind of think through the body and do stuff like that, I think is really beneficial. And also just acknowledging that there are different ways of writing a thesis or doing academia. Like, you know, we kind of think of this like linear prose that comes out and everything. But what if there was something different? And I was very fortunate that both of my supervisors have always been like really supportive and really interested in my writing and giving me that space to kind of try different things or recommending texts that were sort of unusual that kind of spoke to my own interests. And I think, you know, I'm very grateful for them for doing that. And I think that, yeah, certainly kind of encouraging those approaches and sharing those resources would be really beneficial, I think.
That's fantastic. It's so encouraging to hear how your supervisor supported you to experiment and find your own path.
Yeah.
I really love what you said about creating space to think and write sort of through the body. And the idea of sharing resources or platforms where disabled researchers can connect around those experiences, I think that's brilliant. And I can really relate to what you said about the expectations of academic writing feeling so linear and polished, especially coming from a STEM background where they often feel more rigid and there's sort of less room for that personal expression or alternative sort of styles or forms of writing.
Yeah.
So it's inspiring to hear how you've managed to bring your own voice and approach into that space and really open that door for others to do the same. And thinking about supervisor relationship, as you said, support makes such a difference. Supervisors often want to help, but may not always know how best to do that. So what kind of support or awareness do you think would make the biggest difference for disabled PGRs?
Well, I think, yeah, there's a lot of things. I think I'll start with what might potentially seem obvious, but I think it's still kind of an important point, which is that I would sort of hope that supervisors would encourage their students to register with disability services if they haven't already done that, to apply for Disabled Students Allowance or DSA. And what's really helpful with that is the fact that I think supervisors or certainly the school or faculty that a student comes from would receive a sort of support summary about that student and all of the different elements of support that they are receiving. And hopefully that would be a really good clarifying place to kind of start there. I know that the university does have some fantastic resources online. I think just this morning I was looking at the ODPL website, which lists really comprehensive things for how supervisors or academics, personal tutors even can support their students. And I think that's really, really helpful. And I think other than that, I think it's just kind of important that it's sort of done on a sort of case by case basis. So I've always been very comfortable talking about my disabilities and my neurodiversity. And I recognise that some students may not be, and that's absolutely fine too. And it's important for students to kind of take a lead on that and for the supervisors to support them accordingly. So I was really fortunate to have a great relationship with both of my supervisors, Amelia DeFalco and Stuart Murray. They've really understood everything I've been going through. Throughout my PhD, I've had lots of new diagnoses. I've had 3 surgeries, and they've always fought for me to have the time I need to have a break and to rest and things like that. They totally get it. Whenever I say, oh, I'm really sorry, but I just need a couple of weeks more to kind of polish this section that I've been struggling with, they always allowed me to have that time, or they encouraged me to meet them occasionally without a submission so that we could just kind of check in and share resources or readings or things like that, which was really, really supportive and helped me to kind of stay engaged even when I had this like internal battle with what I was trying to write about. So thanks, Stuart and Amelia. I think that their support really did help me do my best work, and also the same with disability services. I think I would like to personally mention on here my dyspraxia tutor Jenny Elberg, who has just done everything possible to help me. She's kept me sane for several years, and I don't know how on earth she's done it, so thanks very much, Jenny. But yeah, I would say a combination of looking at the support summary, contacting disability services or ODPL for any kind of professional input there, and also just kind of keeping the conversation going with the student around what they need, I think is probably the best way to manage that.
Brilliant, that's absolutely fantastic summary of how to you know, approach all the different resources and to support supervisors and being able to have those conversations. But also you mentioned, you know, sometimes not everybody feels that they want to share or feel that in a place where they can, and you know, it's important then to kind of navigate those situations as well. You know, we have a course as part of one of our PGR programs, our Quest program, on developing good supervisor relationships and really trying to kind of enable students to really think about how to kind of open up that space and feel feel comfortable and feel heard and have that kind of open, honest conversation from the start. And I think it does take time to build that level of trust up to be able to do that. But also, you know, having the support from the disability services, I think, is really important. And having that voice coming from there can really help support a student in different ways. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that as well and for your shout out as well. Thank you for all of those practical insights into the kind of support structures that are available. But I also know that a lot of support also comes from peers rather than from these kind of formal structures. So you've spoken a bit about sort of peer support and community, other people being involved in supporting you. So what role does that play in navigating academia with disability or chronic illness?
I think it plays an enormous role, really. So I think I kind of feel that community can be anything. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the people in your year group or people doing the same program as you. I found a lot of community just from the books I was reading and feeling that my experiences were represented, even experiences that I never knew another human soul could experience, that particular type of pain or that symptom. And that gave me a lot of solace. I think that I've been very fortunate as well to have a group of friends on Discord from all around the world who are all neurodivergent. We all met kind of primarily through this ADHD app. There's a group of us from Denmark, Puerto Rico, the UK, the US, and we just kind of congregate on there, share to-do lists, try and kind of motivate each other. And that's been really, really powerful. So if anyone from there is listening, hello, thank you very much for your support. I think it's just been incredible to have their support, really, because I don't really have to explain to them how I'm feeling because we all sort of just get it. I also think things like, you know, okay, fair enough, this might sound a bit strange, but I think it's really impossible to understate the importance of having a place to share pet photos. I think that really kind of gets me through the day. And certainly with that group of friends, we're all sharing pictures of our cats and dogs. And I've said hello to my supervisor's dogs on Teams as well, which has definitely kind of helped me to keep going. I would say that, you know, community can be anything. It's certainly possible to have strong community by connecting with people you share an office space with or people from disability services that work with you, but it can also be things that you read, it can be writers, it can be art, it can be anything like that as well. So I'd encourage people to kind of, you know, really try and find that thing that you connect with and keep that close to you as you do your PhD. So yeah.
That's a fantastic bit of advice to do that. And I'm a little disappointed. You mentioned that to me before that your cat might appear on the screen today or say a quick hello.
Yes.
I think absolutely. I'm there with you on the cats. I think we're, you know, wrapping up to the end of our conversation now. I think we've shared so much insight into your disability and pain and how it's experienced, and it's such an important topic, and I really loved how to hear you speak about it as well today, and I'm sure that our listeners have too. So I just really want to explore, you know, what's next for you. Your PhD is finished. Is there any new directions or interests that you're currently exploring?
Well, I think that there is certainly a lot to think about in terms of representing pain. I think that there was one thing that kind of came out from my research that was an unexpected connection, which was that a lot of writers were kind of using the metaphor of a ghost to explore their experience of having constant pain. And I thought that was really interesting because it suggested like things about being invisible, things about kind of having this enduring experience with no end. So it would be really interesting to kind of pursue that as a potential avenue of doing more research. But to be honest, for now, I think I just worked so hard on getting my thesis done and preparing for my viva that I'm just really enjoying doing bits of DIY and sorting out the garage and things like that and giving my body and my brain a bit of a rest before I figure out the next thing. And I think that's an important thing to note too as a disabled researcher, is that you've got to kind of be well. And so that's my current focus for now. And cuddling lots of cats, of course.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That sounds, yeah, absolutely perfect. You definitely need that time out, even for a PGR who doesn't have a disability, you know, just being able to have that break and that shut off time, because it's such an intense period of time in your life. You know, for me, it was quite a while ago now, but I do remember it well. It's been, you know, quite a challenge, really. So, Wow, thank you so much, Nico, for sharing all of your insights and your experiences with us today. It's been really eye-opening for me, and it's been lovely to speak to you, and I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy hearing about it too. So, your work not only deepens our understanding of how pain is represented and misunderstood, but it also challenges research culture to be more inclusive, more embodied, and more responsive to the lived experience. If you'd like to learn more about Nico's research or read her article in Medical Humanities, you'll find a link in the show notes. And if you're a researcher navigating disability or chronic illness, we hope this conversation reminds you that your experience matters and that there's a growing community working to make academia more accessible and more humane. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.